Yosef Vissarionovich Djivashvili was not born on 21st of December 1879, Stalin's official birthday. Soso was actually born in a tiny shack over a year earlier, in Gori, a small town beside the Kura River, in the romantic, mountainous, and defiantly un-Russian province of Georgia. A small country, closer to Baghdad than St. Petersburg. An independent kingdom for millennia, Georgia had its own ancient language, traditions, cuisine, literature. It was only consumed by Russia in gulps between 1801 and 1878. With its sunny climate, clannish blood feuds, songs and vineyards, it resembled Sicily more than Siberia. Soso's father was a violent, drunken, semi-itinerant cobbler who savagely beat both Soso and his mother, Keke, who in turn thrashed her son mercilessly. She was pious and became close to the priests who protected her. When her husband later forcibly took Soso to be a cobbling apprentice in Tiflis, priests helped get him back. Stalin had a pock-marked face from an attack of smallpox, and had a damaged left arm, possibly from a carriage accident. He grew up into a sallow, stocky, surly youth, with speckled honey-coloured eyes and thick black hair, a Kinto, a Georgian street urchin. He was exceptionally intelligent, with an ambitious mother who wanted him to be a priest. In 1888, he entered the Gori Church School, and then, triumphantly, in 1894, won a 5-ruble scholarship to the Tiflis Seminary in the Georgian capital. Stalin sometimes sent money to help his mother, but henceforth kept his distance from Keke, whose dry wit and rough discipline resembled his own. There's been too much cod psychology about Stalin's childhood, but this much is certain. Raised in a poor, priest-ridden household, he was damaged by violence, insecurity, and suspicion, but inspired by the local traditions of religious dogmatism, blood feuding, and romantic brigandry. He was emotionally stunted and lacked empathy, yet his antennae were supersensitive. He was abnormal, but Stalin himself understood that politicians often are. History, he wrote later, is full of abnormal people. The seminary provided his only formal education. Its catechismic teaching and Jesuitical methods of surveillance, spying, invasion of the inner life, the violation of people's feelings, repelled but impressed Soso so acutely that he spent the rest of his life refining their style and methods. In 1899, he was expelled from the seminary, joined the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, and became a professional revolutionary, adopting the name Koba. He combined the science of Marxism with his soaring imagination. He published romantic poetry in Georgian before working as a weatherman at the Tiflis Meteorological Institute, the only job he held before becoming one of the rulers of Russia in 1917. Koba was convinced by the universal panacea of Marxism, a philosophical system that suited his obsessive character. The class struggle also matched his own melodramatic pugnacity. The paranoid secrecy of the intolerant and idiosyncratic Bolshevik culture dovetailed with Koba's own self-contained confidence and talent for intrigue. He plunged into the underworld of revolutionary politics that was a seething, stimulating mixture of conspiratorial intrigue, ideological nitpicking, scholarly education, factional games, love affairs with other revolutionaries, police infiltration, and organizational chaos. These revolutionaries hailed from every background: Russians, Armenians, Georgians and Jews, workers, noblemen, intellectuals and daredevils. They organized strikes, printing presses, meetings and heists. United in the obsessional study of Marx's literature, there was always a division between the educated bourgeois émigrés like Lenin and the rough men of action in Russia itself. The underground life, always itinerant and dangerous, was the formative experience not only of Stalin, but of all his comrades. In 1902, Koba won the spurs of his first arrest and Siberian exile, the first of 7, from which he escaped 6 times. These exiles were far removed from the brutal concentration camps Stalin himself would later employ. They were almost reading holidays in distant Siberian villages, with one part-time gendarme on duty, during which revolutionaries got to know and sometimes hate each other, corresponded with their comrades in Petersburg or Vienna, discussed abstruse questions of dialectical materialism, and had affairs with local girls. When the call of freedom or revolution became urgent, they escaped, yomping across the taiga to the nearest train. In exile, cobra's teeth, a lifelong source of pain, began to deteriorate. Cobra avidly supported Vladimir Lenin and his seminal work, What Is to Be Done? This domineering political genius combined the Machiavellian practicality of seizing power with mastery of Marxist ideology. Exploiting the schism that would lead to the creation of his own Bolshevik party, Lenin's message was that a supreme party of professional revolutionaries could seize power for the workers and then rule in their name in a dictatorship of the proletariat, until this was no longer necessary, because socialism had been achieved. Lenin's vision of the party as the advanced detachment of the army of proletarians, a fighting group of leaders, set the militarist tone of Bolshevism. In 1904, on Cobra's return to Tiflis, he met his future father-in-law, Sergei Aleluyev, 12 years his senior, a skilled Russian electrical artisan, married to Olga Fedorenko, a strong-willed beauty with a taste for love affairs with revolutionaries. It was whispered that Olga had an affair with the young Stalin. According to her granddaughter, Svetlana, Olga always had a soft spot for Stalin. Such short liaisons were everyday occurrences among revolutionaries. Long before Stalin and Nadia fell in love, they were part of the Bolshevik family who passed through the Aleluyev household. There was another special link. Cobra met up with the Aleluyevs on holiday and saved Nadia from drowning in the Caspian Sea, a romantic bond if ever there was one. Cobra, meanwhile, married Yekaterina, Kato, a placid, darkly pretty Georgian, daughter of another Bolshevik family, and the sister of Alexander Svanitsa, who joined Stalin's Kremlin entourage. Living in a hut near the Baku oil fields, Kato gave him a son, Yakov. But Cobra's appearances at home were sporadic and unpredictable. During the 1905 revolution, in which Leon Trotsky, a Jewish journalist, bestrode the Petersburg Soviet, Cobra claimed he was organizing peasant revolts in the Kartli region of Georgia. After the Tsarist backlash, he traveled to a Bolshevik conference in Tammerfors, Finland, his first meeting with his hero, Lenin. The next year, Cobra traveled to the Congress in Stockholm. On his return, he lived the life of a Caucasian brigand, raising party funds in bank robberies or expropriations. After he returned from a congress in London, Cobra's beloved, half-ignored Kato died in his arms of tuberculosis on the 25th of November, 1907. Cobra was heartbroken, yet he left their son Yakov to be brought up by Kato's family. After hiding in the Aleluyev's Petersburg apartment, he was recaptured and returned to his place of banishment, the remote one-horse town Solvitchikotsk. Here, in January 1910, Cobra moved into the house of a young widow named Maria Kutsakova, by whom he fathered a son. After yet another escape, Cobra returned to Petersburg in 1912, sharing digs with a ponderous Bolshevik who was to be the comrade most closely associated with him. Vyacheslav Scriabin, just 22, had followed the Bolshevik custom of assuming a macho nom de revolution and called himself Molotov, the Hammer. Cobra also assumed an industrial alias. It was no coincidence that Stalin sounds like Lenin. This wonderful Georgian, as Lenin called him, was co-opted by the party's Central Committee at the end of the Prague Conference of 1912. In November, Stalin travelled to Krakow to stay with Lenin. The leader supervised his keen disciple in the writing of an article expressing Bolshevik policy on the sensitive nationality question. Marxism and the national question, arguing for holding together the Russian Empire, won him ideological kudos and Lenin's trust. In February 1913, Stalin was rearrested and given a suspiciously light sentence, giving some credence to the idea that he was a double agent of the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret police. But as the Okhrana admitted in their reports, he remained a fanatical Marxist. The military blunders and food shortages of the First World War inexorably destroyed the Russian monarchy, which, to the surprise of the Bolsheviks, collapsed suddenly in February 1917, replaced by a provisional government. On the 12th of March, Stalin reached the capital and visited the Alleluyevs. Nadia, now a striking brunette of 16, her sister Anna and her brother Fyodor, questioned the returning hero about his adventures. He found that Molotov was editing Pravda, a job which Stalin immediately commandeered for himself. While Molotov had taken a radical anti-government line, Stalin was more conciliatory. Lenin, who arrived on the 4th of April, overruled Stalin's vacillations. In a rare apology to Molotov, Stalin conceded, "You were closer to Lenin." But when Lenin needed to escape to Finland to avoid arrest, Stalin hid him chez Alleluyev, shaved off his beard, and escorted him to safety. On the 25th of October 1917, Lenin launched the Bolshevik Revolution. When Lenin formed the new government, Stalin founded his Commissariat of Nationalities with one secretary, young Fyodor Alleluyev, and one typist, Nadia. In 1918, the Bolsheviks struggled for survival. Faced with a galloping German advance, Lenin and Trotsky were forced to make the pragmatic Brest-Litovsk Agreement, ceding much of Ukraine and the Baltics to the Kaiser. After Germany's collapse, British, French, and Japanese troops intervened while white, anti-Bolshevik armies converged on the tottering regime, which moved its capital to Moscow to make it less vulnerable. Lenin's beleaguered empire soon shrunk to the size of medieval Muscovy. In August, Lenin was wounded in an assassination attempt, avenged by the Bolsheviks in a wave of terror. In September, Lenin, recovered, declared Russia a military camp. His most ruthless troubleshooters were Trotsky, the war commissar, creating and directing the Red Army from his armored train, and Stalin, the only two leaders allowed access without appointment to Lenin's study. Both became members of Lenin's new five-man executive decision-making organ, the Politburo. The bespectacled Jewish intellectual was the hero of the revolution, second only to Lenin himself, while Stalin seemed a rough provincial. But Trotsky's patronizing grandeur offended the plain-spoken old illegals of the regions, who were more impressed with Stalin's hard-nosed practicality. Stalin identified Trotsky as the main obstacle to his rise. The city of Tsaritsyn played a decisive role in Stalin's career and his marriage. In 1918, this key strategic city on the lower Volga, the gateway to the grain and oil of the North Caucasus, and the southerly key to Moscow, looked as if it was likely to fall to the whites. Lenin dispatched Stalin to Tsaritsyn as Director General of Food Supplies in South Russia, but Stalin soon managed to get his status raised to Commissar with sweeping military powers. In an armored train with 400 Red Guards, Fyodor and Nadia, Stalin steamed into Tsaritsyn on the 6th of April to find the city beset with ineptitude and betrayal. Stalin showed he meant business by shooting any suspected counter-revolutionaries. Lenin ordered him to be ever more merciless and ruthless. Stalin replied, "Be assured, our hand will not tremble." It was here that Stalin grasped the convenience of death as the simplest and most effective political tool. He was hardly alone in this. During the Civil War, the Bolsheviks, clad in leather boots, coats, and holsters, embraced a cult of the glamour of violence, a macho brutality that Stalin made his own. It was in Tsaritsyn that Stalin met and befriended Voroshilov and Budyonny, both at dinner on the night Nadia died, who formed the nucleus of his military and political support. When the military situation deteriorated in July, Stalin effectively took control of the army. This was the sort of leadership the revolution required to survive. But it was a challenge to Trotsky, who had created his Red Army with the help of ex-Tsarist officers. Stalin distrusted these useful renegades and shot them whenever possible. He resided in the plush railway carriage, decorated in light blue silk, that had once belonged to a gypsy torch singer. Here, Nadia and Stalin probably became lovers. She was 17, he was 39. It must have been a thrilling, terrifying adventure for a schoolgirl. Stalin married Nadia on their return to Moscow, moving into a modest Kremlin flat, shared with the whole Alleluia family, and later a fine dacha at Zubalova. In May 1920, after the Poles had captured Kiev, Stalin was appointed political commissar to the southwestern front. The Politburo ordered the conquest of Poland to spread the revolution westwards. The commander of the Western Front, pushing on Warsaw, was a brilliant young man named Mikhail Tukhachevsky. When Stalin was ordered to transfer his cavalry to Tukhachevsky, he refused until it was already too late. The vendettas reverberating from this fiasco ended in slaughter 17 years later. In 1921, Nadia showed her Bolshevik austerity by walking to hospital to give birth to Vasily. Meanwhile, she worked as a typist in Lenin's office, which was to prove very useful in the coming intrigues. The vanguard of Bolsheviks, many young and now blooded by the brutality of the struggle, found themselves a tiny, isolated, and embattled minority, nervously ruling a vast, ruined empire, itself besieged in a hostile world. Contemptuous of the workers and peasants, Lenin was nonetheless surprised to discover that neither of these classes supported them. Lenin thus proposed a single organ to rule and oversee the creation of socialism, the party. It was this embarrassing gap between reality and aspiration that made the party's quasi-religious fidelity to ideological purity so important, its military discipline so obligatory. In this peculiar dilemma, they improvised a peculiar system and sought solace in a uniquely peculiar view of the world. The party's sovereign organ was the Central Committee, CC. The top 70 or so officials who were elected annually by party congresses, which later were held ever less frequently. The CC elected the small Politburo, a super-war cabinet that decided policy, and a secretariat to run the party. In 1922, Lenin engineered the appointment of Stalin as General Secretary of the CC. Stalin's secretariat was the engine room of the new state, giving him sweeping powers, which he demonstrated when he and Sergei Argenikidze annexed Georgia, which had seceded from the empire, and then imposed their will on the independent-minded Georgian party. Lenin was disgusted, but a stroke in December 1922 prevented him moving against Stalin. Lenin alone could see that Stalin was emerging as his most likely successor, so he secretly dictated a damning testament, demanding Stalin's dismissal. Lenin was felled by a fatal stroke on the 21st of January 1924. Against the wishes of Lenin and his family, Stalin orchestrated the effective deification of the leader and his embalming like an Orthodox saint in a mausoleum on Red Square. Stalin commandeered the sacred orthodoxy of his late hero to build up his own power. An outsider in 1924 would have expected Trotsky to succeed Lenin, but in the Bolshevik oligarchy his fame counted against the insouciant war commissar. The hatred between Stalin and Trotsky was not only based on personality and style, but also on policy. Stalin had already used the massive patronage of the secretariat to promote his allies, Molotov, Voroshilov, and Argenikidze. He also supplied a realistic alternative to Trotsky's insistence on Europe-wide revolution, socialism in one country. The other members of the Politburo, led by Grigory Zinoviev and Kamenev, Lenin's closest associates, were terrified of Trotsky, who had united all against him. So when Lenin's testament was unveiled in 1924, Kamenev proposed to let Stalin remain as secretary, little realizing that there would be no other real opportunity to remove him for 30 years. Trotsky, the revolution's preening panjandrum, was defeated with surprising ease and speed. Having dismissed Trotsky from his power base as war commissar, Zinoviev and Kamenev discovered too late that Stalin was the real threat. By 1926, Stalin had defeated them too, helped by his rightist allies Nikolai Bukharin and Alexei Rykov, who had succeeded Lenin as premier. Stalin and Bukharin supported the NEP, the New Economic Policy, a degree of capitalism which had been instituted by Lenin to save the regime. But many of the regional hardliners feared that compromise undermined Bolshevism itself, putting off the day of reckoning with the hostile peasantry. In 1927, a grain crisis brought this to a head, unleashed the Bolshevik taste for extreme solutions, and set the country on a repressive martial footing that would last until Stalin's death.